GW Productions is your portal to pop culture. Fan of The Walking Dead, Z Nation, or zombie movies? Make an appointment with the Doctor of the Dead, featuring world-renowned zombie expert Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg. Follow him on Twitter, at Doctor of the Dead. Doctor Who fan? Then step into the vortex with two published and produced Doctor Who experts, at Who's Talking Cast. And for movies, comics, TV shows, games, toys, and more, the G2V Podcast, the official podcast of G2V Productions, is your pop culture magazine for everything under the sun. At G2V Podcast. That's the G2V Productions lineup, available on iTunes at itunes.com/G2V. And visit the official website for shows, articles, and links at g2vpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Chavo Guerrero Jr. from Lucha Underground, and you're listening to the Handsome TV Express.
Well, hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 33 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you can find over on iTunes or your awesome podcast app. Just look for Dan and Travis. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift series of podcasts that attempt and quite frankly are succeeding in finding the culture in pop culture. This and just tons of other great podcasts are available over at www.chronicrift.com. I want to thank everybody for downloading, listening, retweeting, and spreading the word about the pretty fantastic interview with us, Chavo Guerrero, last week. Yeah, he's a pretty awesome guy. Pro wrestlers are fun dudes and ladies. And hopefully over the next year, we're going to get some more pro wrestlers on because it's just a blast to talk to those guys. Speaking of having a blast, two passions in my life are wrestling and Doctor Who, as those of you who read my Doctor Who guide know. And so I'm delighted to welcome, last week you did wrestling, this week we're diving into the world of Doctor Who with a very accomplished Doctor Who author who's written, he's published original Doctor Who stories for BBC Books. He is also a writer and producer for I don't even know how many Big Finish audio stories, most notably in some of the Doctor Who spin-off world, like the world of Bernice Summerfield and Graceless, and has written first-run Doctor Who for the Big Finish line. He's also contributed to fiction and nonfiction to many publications, and in his spare time, he's even made a film or two with his brother Thomas. Welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Simon Garrier.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Now, your latest venture is actually a really interesting a book that's coming out June 4th called The Scientific Secrets of Doctor Who, which sort of is both fiction and nonfiction. Tell us all about it and how it came to be.
Right. Well, yes, it's a mix of fiction and nonfiction. So it's 15 short stories, mm-hmm. original short Doctor Who stories, one for each of the first 11 Doctors and four for the 12th Doctor, as played by Peter Capaldi. I edited those stories. I didn't write them, but I briefed each of the authors I gave them the Doctor, the incarnation of the Doctor they were writing, and a scientific theme. So, for example, the first story is written by a brilliant writer called Mark Wright, who I know you know, Tim.
Oh, he's awesome.
And I gave Mark, I want a story with the 12th Doctor. It needs to be about alien planets and alien life. And actually, with that one, I suggested, how about something set in the clouds of Venus? And off he went and wrote an amazing story. And then after each of those stories with a theme, I and my co-author, Dr. Marek Kakula, from the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, just in London, he and I basically discuss that scientific theme in more depth and tie in lots of TV Doctor Who examples and kind of draw it out. So the idea is it's a kind of fun, exciting read. And the essays that we've written, they explore aspects of science in ways that you might not have thought about, and they explore aspects of Doctor Who in ways that you might have thought about. Oh, so hopefully you'll be thinking about science and Doctor Who together and separately, new and different ways, and it's all good fun.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about science in Doctor Who is, you know, with the 50-year history and however many seasons, 37 seasons I think we're up to, they've gotten science very, very right in some stories, and they've gotten science very, very wrong in some stories. And, you know, when, like, the TARDIS was first introduced, this idea of a bigger place that you access through another dimension probably sounded very far-fetched and outlandish in 1963. But in 2015, there's a lot of discussion about multiverse theory and dimensional travel. So how did you guys tackle that sort of... okay, we know this bit in this story is kind of rubbish. Or maybe it's rubbish now, but might be more realistic later. Like, how did you tackle the scientific, just plethora of incongruent, the plethora of science explored in Doctor Who?
Well, it's tricky, because sometimes, you know, some authors and production teams and, you know, because there are a lot of people have worked on Doctor Who with very different ideas about what matters and what doesn't.
Right.
And some of them thought they got their science right, and it turned out that they didn't. Some of them made stuff up that sounded funny or exciting, and that turned out decades later to be right.
Right.
There's all sorts of things. So for some people, the science stuff mattered. For other people, the science stuff didn't matter. You know, Stephen Moffat, who's the executive producer and head writer now, wrote in Doctor Who magazine, the sort of official fan magazine, earlier this year, in reply to somebody who was criticising one of his episodes. And Stephen kind of said, you know, you're criticising this episode because the science wasn't right. And that didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
But I get what you're saying. I'll bear that in mind. You know, and so you can see that these people's ideas are changing about these things. So we didn't want to write a book that was about, you know, sort of ticking off which episodes have got it right and which episodes have got it wrong. Because I think there's a broader way of interrogating the material, which is that just the stories are full of ideas, or they're unconsciously full of things from their own time. So the very first Dalek story, which the first episode of which was in 1963, and then it ran through to 64, is full of anxieties about nuclear power and atomic energy, yeah, and the attitude with which these things are used. And it doesn't really matter what the author's intentions or the production team's intentions were. It's still of itself interesting to talk about and examine. So that was kind of our idea, which really to use it as a springboard rather than to judge episodes for, for their scientific accuracy. But there are examples where the science is very, very good. And as you say, examples where it's just nonsense.
Well, I think it's interesting you point out tapping into current events, because two stories, without getting too deep in the weeds here, there's two stories, and just to sum up for now, Doctor Who fans, that spring to my mind is like, wow, they have gotten better with age and more interesting with age. One is the Ice Warriors and the other is the Green Death, because they deal with environmental calamities that were sort of on the mind of people in the 70s, but now are headlines and newspapers. And while the Ice Age scenario of the Ice Warriors is probably not as realistic as what happens in the Green Death, basically, the Ice Warriors is the Doctor and his friends land in the far future where there's an ice age. And it fills there's a very chilling line where somebody says, one year there just was no spring. And then Green Death deals with a company that decides to ignore environmentalism and creates a slew of radioactive monsters on the countryside. That stuff has become even more relevant through the passage of time, almost through no fault of the writers. So looking at the Daleks and some of those stories, do you think it's more important to be scientifically accurate or more scientifically current when approaching some of these stories?
That is a tricky question, because there's a number of things in that question. First of all, how much is my opinion valid? You know, how much does my opinion count over anybody else's in a show that's been written and produced by lots and lots of different people, all with their own views? You know,
mm-hmm.
When it comes down to it, my opinion doesn't matter any more than anybody else's. I don't think it matters very much at all. And we've tried to be fairly objective in terms of discussing the details and not putting too much of our own opinions in there, because we want it to be a springboard for readers. We want readers to come up with their own ideas and kind of think about it themselves and see where it takes them. I think there are, if you compare Doctor Who to a show like Star Trek,
right,
certainly in the sort of 80s and 90s, Star Trek seemed to be very keen to take scientific advances and scientific ideas of its time that they were making the show and extrapolate from that directly into what the technology of 500 years or whatever might be. And there are some problems with that, because it means you're kind of lashing yourself to the mast of what we know now, and those theories and those materials might age very quickly. They might become very dated. You know, like if you did a story about, I don't know, steady state theory, you know, in the 50s or 60s, you would that would now look very old fashioned and stuff. And you can see that in both Star Trek and Doctor Who, where they've made predictions or they've talked about stuff which we now think of as having been superseded. I think there are a number of things in Doctor Who where, because it doesn't generally do that, so there are examples of it having done that, I think Doctor Who tends to cast its net a bit wider. So it's more, it's less specific about scientific progress as it is while the show's being made. And that makes it freer to make kind of broad brush statements about things or to come up with ideas. And those ideas, just by being big and imaginative, tend to be more on the nail. Mm. I think, you know, one of the examples we give is that in a 1973 story, Planet of the Daleks, just to make it a bit more interesting, there's a Dalek army and the Doctor fights against it by setting off a volcano, except on the alien planet it happens on, that volcano isn't one that spews molten lava. It's an ice volcano. So this molten sea of ice buries the Dalek army. And that's just a bit of, you know, fantasy excitement. It's a bit of making that planet a bit more interesting and kind of the writer just thinking imaginatively. And as we say, you know, that was in 1973. In 1989, Voyager 2 passing Neptune, last thing it does before it disappearing out into the darkness of space is to take a photograph of Triton, the moon. And lo and behold, on Triton, they have these ice volcanoes, and Terry Nation, by complete fluke, got it bang on the nail. And we now know that there's cryovolcanism, the scientific word, on several moons in the solar system. And those sort of things are, you know, that in the very first episode of Doctor Who, one of the ways they make the Doctor's granddaughter seem strange is they show her at school in London, and she's asked to do a maths problem using the three dimensions A, B, and C. And she says, you can't do a problem in A, B, and C without D and E as well. So the dimensions of height, width, and length, you also need time and space as well. And at the time, that's just a bit of, you know, sci-fi gobbledygook and stuff. But I've been chatting to a mathematician who was going, no, that's a pretty profound statement on pure mathematics right there. And that wasn't what the writer intended. But actually, that just by thinking imaginatively and thinking outside of what we know and what we take for granted, immediately you're doing things that are very interesting from a scientific perspective. Yeah. So those are the kinds of things we were interested in.
And of course, we wish Voyager luck as it travels to the machine planet, becomes V'ger, and comes back to us. But
they haven't actually launched Voyager 6 yet, but you know.
Oh, I thought
another way in which Star Trek has not got it absolutely right.
No, they haven't. But good attempts, and you know, I mean, Captain Picard did have an iPad, so that one always blows me away. But and that ice volcano scene, just for the record, I think when I was 10, I watched that scene about 500 times. But the cool thing about what you're saying, though, as far as science goes, I think, you know, there's always those specials on TV that are like, you know, real-life archaeology isn't gunfights like Indiana Jones, and sometimes there's this temperance of the action-adventure world of science, of course. But we've seen with like some of this stuff you're describing, and like Cosmos, which came back last year with Neil deGrasse Tyson, is science is actually filled with these big, crazy, zany ideas. And so many people who have made scientific history throughout the centuries, were seen as like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. That can't be right. That can't be. That's an insane, impossible idea. And it turned out that they've changed our world and civilization. So I think that's a cool thing to concentrate on that in this book.
I think something that both Doctor Who and science do in their own respective ways is kind of undermine common sense views of how the world around us works. Because science, you know, a lot of things we now know to be scientifically accurate are quite counterintuitive. You know, things like the Earth isn't flat, that we're actually on a planet spinning really fast, and it's rotating on its axis really fast, and really fast it's moving around this giant nuclear explosion in space. Those sorts of things. Vaccination is counterintuitive. You know, it came from spotting a link between milkmaids who got cowpox from the cows that they work with, then not getting smallpox. And it's like, well, if we inject some of the cowpox into people, will they get smallpox? No, they don't. And we eradicate a disease by vaccination and stuff. And those things are, you know, at the time, people were going, so you want to inject children with cowpox?
Yeah.
Right. That's, you know, and those things are very hard to get. There's people still stoked. You know, quantum mechanics is very difficult to get your head around. And lots of people at the time it was happening in the 1920s that people were talking about it were going, no, but we had this idea about atoms being like billiard balls. We kind of understood how those things worked. And this is much more complicated and much less easy to grasp. And Doctor Who is full of that, which is, you know, you land on an ordinary street in the middle of the day, and the sat-nav is actually controlled by aliens and wants to kill you. The lampposts are actually controlled by aliens and they're going to kill you. The dummies in the shop windows are aliens and whatever. And it's all about making that kind of familiar thing and the familiar setting more interesting and stranger and whatever. And so there's something going on there as well, I think. And so you're looking and seeing something new in what's apparently ordinary and that other people take for granted. So I think there's, without pushing it too far, there are parallels in that.
So who would you describe is the audience for this book? Because now Doctor Who is also very tricky thing to kind of market and write in some ways, because we're now into like almost the second or third new generation of kids who are watching Doctor Who since it came back. But there's also people like me who are 38, you know, maybe look 33, but are actually 38, and who are going to run around and buy every single thing that says Doctor Who on it and read it. So how do you sort of, did you guys, like, how did you temper that and figure out, okay, who are we writing for in this piece?
Well, there's two parts to that question, because the BBC are very aware of who the audience for Doctor Who is. And BBC Worldwide did some audience research a few years ago, and they have three brackets for Doctor Who.
Okay.
And there are there's the kind of 8 to 80 view, but what you're really talking about, you know, of people aged 8 to 80, but what you're talking about is families. So kids, probably 8 to 12 is sort of the peak for being a kid into it, and you watch it with your family, and it's something that you maybe share together and that sort of stuff. So that's one audience. There's then the audience of handsome devils who are about 38 or older, who've stuck with it since they were younger, have disposable income, are very interested in how it's made, will fork out 40 quid for collector's item material, you know, like statues or particularly lavish books. And then there's a kind of a third part of that, which is, it's described in various different ways, but the way I have experienced it in person is American women in their early 20s. And who are the, you know, that's generalizing, and it's more complicated than that, but it's people who've got into it since it came back in 2005, who probably got into it when they were, you know, 12 or in their teens or whatever, and have stuck with it. And they are aware of this huge backlog of Doctor Who from before they got into it. And in some cases, they've dipped a toe in it. In some cases, they know it very well and they're buying Big Finish, or they know Big Finish, or they're buying comics, or they're, you know, whatever. But in the large case, they don't quite know where to start. You know, they might have seen, some, you know, a couple of older Doctor Who's, but they're just like, you know, what they need, or what they're after, is someone to direct them to the good stuff, mm-hmm. and to kind of lead them through it. And what that tends to mean is, if you've got those three distinct groups, is it's very difficult to market anything to all of them at once. So what BBC Books does, for example, is over the course of a year, you get books that target that group or those two groups or that group, and they vary it up. And so over the course of the year, there's something for everyone. Mm. And that, you know, that's, and my book, the science book, fits in with the novel of City of Death that James Goss has adapted from a script by Douglas Adams. And it ties in with the three new Peter Capaldi novels, and it ties in with the various other bits and pieces that they're doing. As for who I thought I was writing it for, I'm a my co-author Marek is a bona fide space scientist whose PhD is he worked for years at the radio telescope at Jodrell Bank in Northern England. His job is to is a public astronomer, so he you know, gives lectures and talks to schools and appears on TV and things like that. Whereas I am a sort of shambling art student who failed my science exams and have kind of come to it all late. And I took the sort of school exam in astronomy a couple of years ago because I'd got back into it. And so between us, that's kind of the thing. So I hope it's a science book that will appeal to and fascinate people who don't normally read that sort of thing. And I wrote it with my wife in mind, who's not particularly scientifically minded. I wrote it with my mum in mind as a sort of casual reader, and tried to fill it with things that I thought they would find fascinating. Whereas Marek is worrying about graduate level scientists reading it, and is there enough for them? Is it going to carry them? So I think between us, we built something that we hope will have a broad appeal. But you know, who knows?
Yeah, well, just for the record, Simon failed his science classes because he said you have to do the math problem with space and time as the extra dimensions. His ideas were too big for the class at the time.
Exactly. So clever. Yeah.
We actually have been very well behaved 20 minutes into this podcast, because Simon and I go way back, and we're being quite well behaved compared to some of the times we've had. But well,
professional.
Yes, we are being very professional. Well, the thing about science that's interesting is that, like, there's, like, it's funny when I asked about that sort of marketing, it's tricky because you could say, okay, well, I'm going to write a science book for 10-year-olds. But that doesn't really work, because a lot of 10-year-olds are a lot more into science and smarter about science than people who are 50. You know, I have a niece who's 5, and when she's 10, she is going to be teaching me things about science and climate and all that stuff, how it works. So it's not necessarily as easy as, like, one demo, because, like, a kid could read this book and explain some of the stuff to his or her parents.
Yeah. And you find that with all sorts of things. I have written a science book for 10-year-olds. I wrote do you have Top Trumps in the States?
I don't know. We might.
Okay, it's like a kid's card game, but I wrote a Top Trumps Book of Space to accompany a cards game. And what you're dealing with there is it's not about actually the material. It's more about the register, the tone with which you talk about it, the vocabulary you use. And those things are true of any kind of type of writing and stuff. You can, you know, one of the things that we were very keen on with this book is to make it quite accessible in terms of language and chatty. And that was one of the hardest things to get, you know. So I had a few goes at the opening chapter. And once I felt I got it, I sent that to the editor and the various people at the BBC and stuff, and we kind of chatted it back and forth. And once you've kind of got the voice of the book, then it's much easier to press on from there. But you see it with Doctor Who as well, that, you know, the sort of great gag about Doctor Who, when it does complicated plots, is the kids get it.
Yeah.
And then explaining it to the adults. And, you know, and that's
I know
that's how it's going. So
I knew I felt a little old watching Doctor Who when I watched The Impossible Astronaut and was like, I don't know if I understand this. But I knew if I was 10, I would have understood every word of it, you know.
But also, I watched a lot of Doctor Who as a kid and didn't understand it. The idea that I would be expected to just never seemed important. You know, it's just, I adore the last of Tom Baker's stories, Logopolis. I'm still not sure I understand what's going on in it. And it just seems, you know, a mad and exciting and strange program. The sense of it didn't bother me in the slightest. And also, as an adult, you're not, you know, maybe you're not paying as much attention. You're not investing in it as much as. But anyway, I don't know.
I don't know. It could be. How did your collaboration with your co-author come about?
I've known Marek for years and years now, sort of 6-7 years, and we were match made originally. He works at the Royal Observatory, which is part of the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, which is a collection of sort of historic sites to do with Navy and the Navy and Observatory and stuff. And my wife used to work there a long time ago, and her former manager suggested me to Marek when he was talking about doing some sort of events for kids at the observatory. So I did that. On the back of that and us getting on, we shot the we made an extra for the DVD of a Tom Baker Doctor Who story called The Sunmakers, which is set on Pluto. And my brother and I made the making of for the DVD, and we shot that at Greenwich and put Marek in it and got various other people, and that worked out very well. And Marek, at one of the events that I did for him, talked about, he just mentioned this issue of litter in space and bits of space debris that's in orbit and how it damages other spacecraft and stuff. And I just sat there thinking, there's a story in that. So I pitched a story to Big Finish about a collision in orbit. And it got commissioned, and I wrote it, and I sent the outline to Marek, and went, this is kind of what I'm thinking of doing. And he said, well, there's kind of two types of question you're asking me here. Some of them are very complicated, and I'm going to have a think about them and maybe consult some colleagues. And some of the questions you're asking are about such basic science that I'm even embarrassed that you've asked them. So I'll do the deal. We run this GCSE class, which is basically the exam that kids take at 16 in astronomy. And we're running it as a night class for adults. You come and sit that course, and I will go and ask the complex questions and come up with the answers to the complex questions. So I was like, oh, that wasn't what I was. I was hoping he'd just do my homework for me.
Yeah.
But I was in the pub telling a mate of mine about this, and my mate Simon Belcher, who has also read the science book in his credit in the back, he said, "Oh, I fancy doing that course." So we went and did it together. And Marek was, he didn't teach the course, but he was around and stuff. And we'd go to the pub after the lessons and he'd come and join us sometimes and stuff. So not only did he then consult on the script, which was a Big Finish story called The Cold Equations. But he, one of my homeworks led to another Big Finish play, The First Wave. And we discussed the science bit of that in the science book. And it's led to all sorts of things, and we've done talks together, and we've done bits and pieces together and stuff. And actually, off the back of the course I did, I suggested to BBC Books doing some sort of science book or some sort of. I originally pitched them a TARDIS manual that would be how to fly the TARDIS, but also practical hints and tips for surviving, you know, and using the stars to navigate and that sort of stuff, which went through various iterations but never quite worked out. And then last year I was literally rung up by the range consultant Justin Richards, who kind of runs the books effectively, And he just said, we want to do a kind of, there's a, you know, there's a physics of Star Trek book. There's the science of Discworld series. You know, there's, you know, a number of these books. And we're thinking about doing a Doctor Who one. Would you be interested? And I was like, this is the book I've been pitching at you for years. And
it's always the way.
Yeah. And they were like, you know, we want you to do it. We'd like Marek involved to give it a bit of sort of scientific credentials, you know, a bit of, you know, the original idea was that he would check it over and stuff. But it became very clear that actually it was going to be a 50-50 thing where he would rein me in. And he wrote, you know, it wasn't just that I wrote it, he wrote bits of it, you know, we were kind of back and forth a bit. So, yeah, it's been a very, very easy thing, and we get on very well, and it's we're hoping to do more stuff.
You guys are like the new version of Jerry Davis and Kit Pedler, and when talking science and Doctor Who, we have to bring those guys up, because for those who don't watch, Jerry Davis and Kit Pedler was a scientist, almost a similar story. Jerry Davis was a writer, Kit Pedler was a scientist, they became friends, very long story short, and they created a very famous villain called the Cybermen. But yeah. The Cybermen may be one of the most, what's the word I'm looking for, like, possible things that may happen in the future. I mean, this is not something that's a million miles away or 100 miles away. There's people who are thinking and talking about this stuff when it comes to prosthetics and things of that nature.
Well, you know, I'm sat here looking at you on Skype, and you've got your headphones on.
I look like a Cyberman.
Yeah, but you know, you're using Skype, you're using computer systems to communicate. You know, I was checking a fact while I was talking to you just a minute ago by Googling it at the same time as talking to you. You know, these sort of digital electronic systems are part of our lives. They are changing the way we live, and we just take them for granted. And you know, I think Rise of the Cybermen in 2006 was very good about kind of pointing out that is something that there is. You know, we do things that we take for granted now that 20 years ago would have been scary sci-fi stuff. And Doctor Who's full of examples of that. You know, the Green Death, which you mentioned before, a 1973 story, has a weird, freaky bit where a character walks down a corridor and a camera turns to follow her. And CCTV was like a scary Doctor Who sci-fi idea. Now it's just, you know, part of life. The greatest show in the galaxy, a 1988 story.
Oh, yes, great story.
Begins with a robot invading the TARDIS, and they're like, what the hell is this? And it goes over and plugs itself into the console and plays an advert, and it's spam.
Yeah.
And that's like a sci-fi joke, and now it's just something we put up with. The War Machines in 1966, the monster in it is a computer that, using a telephone line, can talk to other computers. And it's just like, but that's just the internet. You know, that's just, again, all of those things they show kind of how the things that we take for granted can change, and our perspectives can change, and how technology changes our lives in ways that we don't really keep up on and stuff. There's a bit in Ghostlight, where in 1989 story, where the telephone rings, and there's this old guy going, these infernal contraptions, what's the world coming to? You know, all of that. It's exactly the same kind of thing going on.
Yeah, and just for the record, this is all on audio, but I can see Simon's room, and he does not have these dates up against the wall somewhere. Oh, yeah. This is all from the top of his head, and he's right, by the way. You could check it. It's so funny. I have a guilty pleasure for like some of those shows, like Ancient Aliens and stuff. And you know, Crystal House was on the show, and we talked about some of those paranormal studies and things like that. And I don't know. I have a very open mind about a lot of that stuff, but what you just described cuts a lot of those things apart, and some of the things people say. I think there's some suspicious, interesting things in our history, but it always bothers me when people say, well, they looked up and saw something and they must have just been confused and thought it was their gods or something. Or how would the ancient peoples have known this? And no matter where we are in human civilization, there is no limit to the human imagination. You know, I just don't believe anything Nostradamus said was any kind of prophecy. I think he was probably just a very creative person, because it's not like, you know, there's no limit to human imagination. Like, will people 1,000 years from now look at Star Wars and be like, my God, George Lucas was a prophet who could see the future? But today, and these stories, these are just stories, and this is what the human imagination does, is it taps into that human potential.
Yeah, yeah, I think also, you know, there's a difference between coming up with an explanation for, you know, why the stars are in the sky or whatever, you know, and saying it's a god or it's a jackal or it's a, you know, whatever those things might be. And the sort of scientific method of going, well, how would we test that?
Right.
And that's a completely different thing going. And just because something could be possible or is a cool idea doesn't mean that's true.
Right.
And that, you know, I think, and you know, one of the things that you find in explorations of Doctor Who is certainly within fan circles, you find that things that you've taken for granted as a fan as being what something is, when you actually look at the episodes, you're going, they don't actually say that. They don't actually pinpoint that or whatever. a case in point, in the first chapter of our science book, I referred to the fact that in the very first Doctor Who story, back in the 60s, back in 1963, the TARDIS leaves London in the 1960s and goes back to the Stone Age, where they meet a Stone Age tribe who refer to the sun as Orb. And they have lost the secret of making fire, and life is very, very basic and stuff. And I kind of use that as a metaphor for primitive knowledge and stuff. And my editor, Justin Richards, threw in effectively an atomic bomb right into my lap, a nuclear bomb to be more accurate, into my lap by going, how do we know that story's set on Earth?
Oh, wow.
And it's just like, oh yeah, there's nothing. There's nothing in it that confirms that. And you go, yeah, I've just taken it for granted. And because the whole point of my first chapter was don't take anything for granted, I had to unpick all of that and rework it and take it out and whatever. And those sorts of things are, that, you know, you can see all sorts of examples of that in like fan books, you know, stuff on the internet and whatever. I sometimes get it with people, you know, I've spoken to people at conventions and stuff about bits and pieces I've written, and they go, but yeah, but it's inconsistent with this bit. And I go, that never happened. That's in a secondary text written by somebody who hadn't watched the episodes very closely, and, you know, those sorts of things.
Wow, 30 years watching Doctor Who, I never spotted that. Justin Richards, ooh,
yeah,
wow,
yeah,
brilliant.
It's full of things like that. And I'm still spotting stuff, you know, and I watched a whole bunch of episodes when I should have been writing this book and spotted all sorts of things I've never noticed before.
So in Unearthly Child, they don't just say, the Doctor doesn't say we're slipping back in time at all or we're just traveling back in time. He doesn't say anything like that. It's just, interesting.
It's just assumed.
There are a fair amount of continuity issues in Doctor Who, but Stephen Moffat, God bless him if he's listening, old pal from the galley days and everything, is a brilliant writer, came up with the greatest out of all time, which is wibbly wobbly timey wimey. Boom. Yeah. Done. Everything. And done. But this doesn't match that. Wibbly wobbly timey wimey. So don't worry about it. I mean, my favorite part in all the Austin Powers movies is at the top of the second one, when Austin Powers and Michael York tells Austin Powers, don't worry about all this time. So looks at the audience and goes, and that goes for you too. But there is real time travel stuff that's interesting and fun to explore. But the tricky thing about time travel in Doctor Who is if you look at something like Day of the Daleks, Father's Day, and then several times they talk about time being rewritten and stuff. There is no actual, you know, we can say certain things are scientific fact. We know the sun is spinning around the sun. The Earth is spinning around the sun. We know certain things. But time travel is still something we are, as a people and as science, just really starting to get into. So that's a big gray area for the world of Doctor Who. Did that present problems during this book?
There are a number of things. One of which, stating the obvious, we are all traveling in time. We're just all moving at the same speed of 1 second per second. And the trick would be to move outside of that, to either go faster or slower and go back into the past. You know, those kind of things. But actually, we know, we're talking on Skype, that is using time dilation. That or not using time, but time dilation comes into us you're in LA and I'm in London, the satellite system that is facilitating our conversation has to take into account the fact that time is moving at a very slightly different speed in orbit from where it, from what it is on the ground. Right. So clocks on the clocks on satellites have to be correct to, I think it's like 100,000th of a second or something, to take account of the of time dilation, which is a something that Einstein came out with, realized with relativity. And the further we get out into space, you know, if we go and colonize Mars or whatever, those things are going to have a bigger impact and stuff. And we can see, you know, like Arthur Eddington and the experiments done in 1919 that proved the theories of relativity were to do with the way that the sun and stuff warp space-time so that objects don't appear, space objects, like the experiment. Sorry, I'm not explaining this very well. The experiment was that Newton came up with all these laws about gravity and how it should work. Mm-hmm. And the position of Mercury as it went around the sun didn't match what Newton said. And Einstein said, well, there's a reason for that. What's happening is that the sun is a large, massive object and it's warping space-time. And as a result of it warping space-time, Mercury's out of place. Mm. And they went, oh, well, all right. When a whole bunch of astronomers, including Arthur Eddington, who was played by David Tennant in the TV version of this, went out and measured a solar eclipse, and Mercury was exactly where Einstein said it would be, not where Newton had said it would be. And they were like, oh, well, there's your evidence for the theory of relativity. And that is an observable, measurable, predictable effect of time travel. Right there, it's not travel in those terms, but it's a thing of time being bent and curved, yeah. And stuff. And those things are real, measurable, predictable phenomena. So yeah, there is this real stuff. The boring kind of corollary to that is that it doesn't make a lot of difference to us, really, does it? Because we just carry on with our lives and plod along. But there are, you know, there's the tragedy is that we can't go back. But actually, that's something that you could, that is equally something that you can tell stories about and deal with and whatever. And actually, Doctor Who does that an awful lot for all he can travel in time. The tragedy is that he can't save people, that right. He can't save his family. He can't, you know, his companions all leave him, that they grow old while he doesn't. All of those things. So you can deal with some real scientific ideas and stuff. The thing is that also because in terms of practical effects that affect us, time travel is still a fairly kind of abstract concept that actually gives you a lot of freedom to tell stories, and you know the rules can change. Yeah. It doesn't matter. If the rules of time travel in Day of the Daleks and the rules of time travel in Father's Day contradict each other, I'm not sure they do, but those things don't matter because you can't, you know, in The Waters of Mars, there's a great bit where the Doctor sort of gives his theory about fixed points in time. But as he says it, he says, you know, but what do I know? That I could be completely wrong. And you go, that's amazing wiggle room. I think much more on the nose wiggle room than the timey-wimey stuff, which is just a sort of hand wave. And those things are important, that not just that actually the acknowledgement that it's not certain is really important from a scientific view as well, because you know otherwise you pin it down to this is what's going on, and 10 years later somebody goes, that's not how black holes work at all, or, you know, right. Whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're still figuring those out. I mean, that's another lot of debate on that. You know, Waters of Mars is a very underrated story. Like, that's a story that's starting to come along with
By who?
A lot of. I'm just saying, that's a story that should be revisited several times. Like, that's one that it took me like a viewing or two to be like, oh, that's what's going on. You know, it's one of those. Now, let's talk a little nuts and bolts here, because you're a proper writer. You are an author. You've written prose. You've written plays.
I'm not very rarely called proper, but yes, go ahead.
Well, hey, you're on the Handsome Timothy Express, so now you are officially a proper writer. And no, there's an interesting thing, though, about going from being a writer to writing your own stories. Now you're like commissioning, you're booking, you're editing other writers. And you also did that in the world of Big Finish when you were a producer for the big Bernie Summerfield range for quite a period of time. How difficult a transition is that? Or is it not a difficult transition at all? Is that something that you enjoy doing? Do you enjoy one or the other? Like, tell us about the difference between those two worlds.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Gosh. Well, if in an ideal world, I wouldn't do any of the admin. I'd just do the writing. I can do producing. I can do editing. It's fine, but I'd far rather just be making this stuff up myself and things. It's a bit like, you know, I'm quite happy at a party to be the one drinking. I can do the washing up. Mm-hmm. I would just rather, you know, if I can get out of it, that, and, you know, it's like if it needs to be done and nobody else is doing it, I can do it, and I can do it pretty well. But I'd rather just be sat in the corner rabbiting on about rubbish and opening another bottle. And I, you know, I'm producing stuff at the moment. I'm producing a documentary for Radio 3, for BBC's Radio 3 at the moment. And that came about because that was how it was going to get made, you know. And I was quite happy to be the writer-researcher. But if I've got to be the producer, and I've made my directorial debut on it as well, because I normally leave that to my brother, and he wasn't able to join us in the studio that day, so I had to direct our friend Toby Haydock playing Albert and H.G. Wells and various other people, and I did that. It's not what I don't have any great aspirations to be a director or things. I think other people are better at it, and I would rather just do the typing and so that's I don't know. Does that answer your question?
It does, and it's an interesting thing.
It happens, really.
Chavo Guerrero talked about this a little bit last week with some of the ways wrestlers becoming their own characters and stuff, and finding a way to do shows when nobody else is doing the shows you want to do. Sometimes there really is something to that. There's a lot of folks who, unfortunately, it's easy to get caught up, whether you're a writer or director, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the, oh, they'll never let me do that, or oh, I can't get this off the, or somebody needs to do this or make this. Well, yeah, that somebody should be you, maybe. Yeah. You know, if
publishing less so, but TV and film is a very practical world. And if you look at crews on TV and film, they all know how to do different jobs, and they can all do, you know, and they pick it up, and they, you know, and if somebody needs to, if you need somebody to do continuity and there's nobody there who's booked to do continuity, you'll find that, you know, the third will do it, or whatever. And I've done stuff on film sets where I've played an extra, or I've held the door open, or I've gone down the road and asked people to be quiet because we're, you know, shooting the scene or whatever. And those, it's just how do you get the thing made? Yep. And I think that kind of practical stuff is very important. And also, I was a project manager before I went freelance and became a writer. And I worked for a magazine company knowing I wanted to be a writer, but there weren't any jobs for writers. They wanted people to run the spreadsheets and stuff. And that's given me a very solid grounding in things like, I don't know, the first book I edited, which was a Big Finish book of short stories, back in 2004, it was picking it up from a writer called Paul Cornell, because he was writing for the Doctor Who TV show. So he'd already set up what he wanted to do, and he needed somebody to take it over. It had to be delivered in something like 6 weeks. I was getting married at the time, and there were questions about, you know, could I do it? Did I have the right sensibility? And actually, the thing is that swung that job for me when I talked to the producer, Gary Russell, was that I knew my way around a spreadsheet. I'd done project management. He kind of said, you know, I'm a bit nervous about giving you this lump of money and what you're going to do with it. And I went, well, I've done this project that was 1.2 million quid. And he went, oh, well, there you go then, you know. Yeah. Fine.
Which is probably the budget for the project, right?
He said, what will happen if the authors don't deliver on time? And I went, well, I'll tell them, I'll give them a deadline that's sooner than it actually is. And if they're difficult, I'll just write their stories and write them badly and put their name on it. And, you know, that is quite a good incentive. And so it's those kind of practical things that got me the writing job. And those kind of things are, you know, and actually it was being a project manager that taught me all the, you know, what makes a bad freelancer, which is that they don't deliver, and they don't deliver what you ask them to, and you're always chasing them, and they're a bit whingy, and they're not very fun. And they, you know, when they come in and see you, they don't talk to people, and they don't remember people's names, and all of those kinds of things, where you just go, those are all things that get you jobs as a writer. So
it's, I think I can share this story at the Doctor Who convention, Gallifrey One, also known as Galley. I got a chance to chat with Derek Sherwin and David J. Howe. And David is an established writer, and Derek Sherwin was the script editor and a very established TV writer from the UK in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it was funny, we were just sort of chatting about, like you and I are now, and it was funny because the consensus was the worst thing a writer can do is actually not write something bad. It's not hand it in. You know what I mean? That's the worst thing almost a writer can do, is not deliver, like you just said. Look, things can be rewritten. Things can be improved upon. Sometimes, I think sometimes writers are crippled by, but what if it's no good? What if they don't like it? What if they hate it? That's actually not the worst fate. The worst fate is delivering something at all.
And also leaving the person you're working for wondering where it is.
Right.
You know, if you're having, everybody has trouble. Everybody, you know, has a bad week or loses the plot or forgets it or, you know, whatever, your crisis. And the thing is that before you're due to hand it in, let them know.
Right. I was just thinking that.
Generally, deadlines are a Friday. And if you go, can I have the weekend? People are like, yeah, it's fine. You know, I'm working on a thing at the moment, which was originally supposed to be in February. And it's, the editor's in no rush for it. And I'm, you know, I'm not very far through it. And it's just keeping him up to date so he never is wondering what's happening. And basically, you as the writer should be doing the chasing. They should never have to chase you. That's the thing.
That's absolutely right.
And that's like, because don't be hard work. Because when it comes to it, you know, there's that great line in Barton Fink about, you know, Barton goes up to see the producer and he's like, you know, oh, you're a writer, kid. You know, you throw a rock in this town, you'll hit a writer.
Yeah.
You know, you have to throw it hard. And that's, you know, there's 100, 200 people who want to do the things that you do. So, you know, you're not important or whatever. And generally, if you're an editor and you've got a lot on your plate, much better to go for a safe pair of hands who delivers you dependable and okay than some tortured genius who's a nightmare and you might not even see it. You know, just, why put yourself through that? And
yeah, and I think it's cool. Let's talk a little bit about Big Finish. We're coming close on time, but I really want to talk some more about the great folks at Big Finish. Now, you mentioned some names there like Mark Wright and Gary Russell and people. And I'm friends with these guys. You're friends with these guys. But at the same time, it's a professional operation. And I think the lesson in your story you tell is you had an opportunity to do one thing, and that was the start of a pretty long relationship in which you were producing the Bernice Summerfield line, the Graceless spinoff, several Doctor Who stories that you talked about, including, it's The Gathering, right? Is the one that you wrote with Hex and Ace?
I wrote The Settling.
Okay, because I know there was a series. All right, I got it wrong. Well, there you have it.
It's a whole series with Ing ending.
That's right. I'm not going to live that one down next galley. Okay.
No, that's a joke. I wish I had written it, because it's Joe Lidstone. Very good.
Yeah, and a friend of the Handsome Timothy Express. But that's a really good story there of the fact that you were able to confidently say, look, I can deliver this piece. I can deliver this, what you need from me. And as a result of that, you then became the safe pair of hands. And since we keep throwing around Big Finish, tell us about the world of Big Finish, the first run audios and stuff like that. What it's been like working with those guys, and why any listener should go and check them out.
Well, it's great. Big Finish is an audio production company. Chiefly, they do radio plays, and they do stuff that's direct sale on CDs, so audiobooks of one sort or another. And that it covers Doctor Who with people who used to be Doctor Who, the old Doctors. They do Blake Seven and Thunderbirds, which is a Gerry Anderson series, and Dark Shadows, and they do all sorts of stuff. All sorts of stuff. And I've written 40, 50 plays for them of one sort or another.
Jeez, that many? Really?
Yeah.
I was going to guess like 20.
No, I think it's maybe you're right, but
I got to catch up. I got to catch up then.
There was a period for about 2 years where I was doing them one a month, and and that because they were a great company to work for. They're very if they like what you're doing, and you know, when you get, it's quite a tricky thing to do, and the different lines and series that they do all come with their own foibles and things you need to consider, you know, like so I've done a lot of a series involving the first two doctors, where the problem is that the actors who play those doctors have long been dead. So how do you tell stories where you don't have the doctor? And that's quite a tricky thing to do, but we get around it. And so it's quite quite a practical, a lot of it is practical stuff. But it's good fun. It's good fun. I'm not doing as much of it as I used to, partly because I'm just busier doing other things. But like the BBC Radio documentary that I'm working on now came directly out of Big Finish. As I said earlier, the science book came out of Big Finish. So yeah, it's great. I couldn't be happy with them.
It's also easier to bring back one of those characters from the dead when you have an actor of the caliber of Gene Marsh, who's a screen icon, was doing several of your Big Finish, reprising her role as Sarah Kingdom.
Yeah. I mean, she's an Emmy award-winning actress. She won Emmys for Upstairs, Downstairs in the 70s. She's in, episodes of The Twilight Zone, and she's in Hitchcock movies and stuff. She's a bit properly amazing.
Yeah.
And, they said, do you want to write one of these stories for her? And I was like, yeah. And she was brilliant. And so he did a few more. She's amazing, absolutely amazing. And got the tone of it, got the, really wrung out the emotion of it. So she makes me, people like that one. And I'm kind of going, yeah, what I did was fairly obvious. And she just made it proper, and... Yeah, good. I've worked with some really, really good. I've worked with her. I've worked with David Warner. I've worked with not on Big Finish, but through Big Finish, I got to work with Mark Gatiss. I worked with a guy called Derek Griffiths, who you probably won't know, but was an actor and children's presenter when I was a kid. So he's a major part of my childhood. And he was amazing and just really threw himself into it and stuff. I've worked with, far too many names to mention of just people who really, people like Louis Jameson, who I adore working with. He's just really, really good and just lifts everything you work on and stuff. And Big Finish is a very friendly, genial place to work as well. There's like any office anywhere, there's sort of squabbles and disagreements and whatever, but I wouldn't have worked there since 2002 if it wasn't just a nice place and fun and stuff. And you get that, you can see it at conventions and whatever, that it just radiates warmth, so I'm very happy doing stuff for them.
It comes through in the material too. I mean, you can tell there's a real quality to all the material out there, which is hard. And Louise Jameson is a frighteningly nice person. I mean, she is just such a kind, kind lady. And we would be very remiss if we did not talk about the lady who brought Bernice Summerfield to life, who's also an actress, director, and photographer. Your good friend Lisa Bowerman.
Yes,
what a talented lady she is.
I saw. I had a very nice. We did a convention on Sunday and had a very nice hour long. She gave me a lift back to London. We had an amazing hour long gossip, putting the world to rights and stuff. I adore working with Lisa. Yes.
Yeah, she's extremely intelligent. Actually, I always joke. Lisa and I have only ever had one conversation. We just take a 4-year break in there, because we're always talking about the business and the industry, and she's a very multifaceted, talented person, and very intelligent too, and a great actress and or actor. But the cool thing about Big Finish, too, is it lets say she's now become a director. And has directed an enormous number of plays and everything. And is a photographer.
Yeah, she's the director I work with most. And there's something, I think partly because I was her producer and we've worked together a lot. We have a kind of, she just gets what I do. It's very rare that I have to explain the tone or the feel I want or whatever. And she's got an extraordinary range of contacts and stuff. So she, you know, she knows everybody in the business. So her casting is impeccable, you know. And there are like, I didn't really know Tom Allen, who was an actor that she cast in a trilogy that we did. I once she said, "This is who we've got," I was like, "Oh yeah, I've heard him on some stuff," but that was pinpoint perfect for what I, you know, and it wasn't actually how I'd seen the character as I'd been writing it, because I'd imagined Dirk Bogarde in the role as a way of pinning a voice on a character. And Lisa kind of went, "No, I think Tom would be doing it." And I was like, "Well, you know, okay, if you think that's a good whatever, I'm happy to go with that." And his first scene, I was just like, "Oh yeah, that's exactly." You know, and then the moment you're doing that, even as we were recording it, the producer, David Richardson's going, "So we should do another one of these." And I was like, "Yeah, I know exactly how that's going to work. And nice. I've got this idea, I can see." And you're immediately just running with it. And that's all Lisa's choices. She's got a really, we were chatting about casting something that we're working on later this year in the car on Sunday. And I kind of went, "Well, yeah, I was thinking of this." And she just named three names off the top of her head. And I was just like, yeah, that's much better than what I thought of. And yeah, so I adore working with Lisa. And yeah, long may that continue.
I have a similar story about her real quick. Is Bernice Summerfield, this character, for those listening, is from the Wilderness Year. She was introduced in novels only. And there were something like 20, 25 novels with Bernice Summerfield. And then she had her own range of novels. And along comes these guys called Big Finish. And I knew the names like Nicholas Briggs and Gary Russell from various things. And they were doing Bernice Summerfield with this Lisa Bowerman lady. That's the thing. I thought it was Lisa Bowerman. And I'm like, "I'm not listening to those. I'm not listening to those because that is not going to be my Bernice Summerfield." I don't know if I've ever told her this story. I may have. I don't know. But I'm like, "I'm not going to listen to those stories because it's not going to be my Bernice." And then I heard a trailer. And I remember hearing, I could not believe it. I was like, "That is the Bernice that I've been hearing in my head for 10 years. And now it isn't, but it is." You know what I mean? It was like, "Oh my God, that's Bernice." And now it's like, Lisa Bowerman is a great
person. It's one of the oddest things. When I was producing The Range, everybody who wrote for that range while I was in charge, and we did 12 one-hour plays and 6 books, and everybody who wrote for that range got her voice spot on.
Yeah.
In a way that, even doing Doctor Who, you know, you're going, "That doesn't sound like Tom Baker. He's a really distinctive sounding person. And that, what you've written, doesn't sound like Tom Baker." I should hasten to add, not George Mann, who wrote the Tom Baker story in the science book, because he got it on the nail. But you do kind of go, it's quite common for people to veer off a character and you have to rein it in as the boss.
Absolutely.
Benny, people just get her. And that's as much, I mean, it's a brilliant character created by Paul Cornell, but the Lisa's so embodied it as a.
So anyway, click on the link below for some Big Finish stuff, including Graceless, which features a cameo by the famous band Handsome Timmy and the D's. Thank you for that. Just about fell out of my chair when I heard that. And also, and then in a few weeks, starting June 4th, I believe it is, 2015, is the release of The Scientific Secrets of Doctor Who. We're going to throw a link down to check it out. We'll throw some tweets and everything, so pick it up. Kids will love all the scientific stuff in it. And parents, don't worry. The kids will explain it to you if you don't understand. It's absolutely great stuff. Simon, just keep killing it in the world of Doctor Who, man. You're one of the good guys. You're keeping the flame of Doctor Who alive, and long may it continue. Thanks so much for taking the time and coming on the show today.
Oh, my great pleasure. It's been really good fun.
All right, awesome. And thank you guys for listening, retweeting, downloading. Got lots more fun stuff coming up in the next few weeks on the Handsome Timmy D Express.